Thank you for being here this evening. And we are in chapter 4 of Ecclesiastes. We've covered chapters 1 through 3. And just to sum up kind of the attitude of the book, the way I'm approaching it, and I think others also, but there's, because it's written in kind of in a poetic way, it's got metaphors in it, because there's certain things that are not necessarily clear. What is the teacher trying to say? He begins in a very negative tone, it appears, meaningless vanity. The word, it means vapor, it means temporary. And what I've concluded as we've got so far into this is that we are basically the teacher, Koheleth, which is Solomon, finds himself now calling the assembly, and it's almost as if he sent out some flyers himself. We're going to do this seminar, and I'm going to tell you the meaning of life. I'm going to explain all the mysteries. Sends out the flyers and then begins to do his research, and then kind of has to conclude. It's like, wait a minute, I can't find the answer. I titled my seminar, The Answers to Life, and then went out to try and find him, and now I have to come back and tell the assembly that I've gathered together. It's like, we can't find the answers to life. It's meaningless. In other words, what we see is life is in this tunnel. Is in here. Out here, there is God. He doesn't deny the existence of God, but he definitely says in different places that God has set certain things beyond our ability. Now, what is unique about that is that's echoed throughout the Scriptures. Paul even bumps up against it. Paul even calls this world futile, which is similar to the word vanity or It's a vapor. It's temporary. John himself says that what we will be out here in eternity, we do not yet know. God is not. We don't have the capacity. Paul says that in 2 Corinthians. He says, "I was even taken into the third heaven, and I saw things that men are not permitted to express. They can't. You can't even. If I went out here and saw it and came back, I couldn't tell you what I saw, because there's nothing in here capable of capturing what's outside there." And so Solomon realizes that in here, something is happening. It's to find the answer, it's meaningless. And he goes with two directions, and this is a review. I've got to hurry so I don't spend all night reviewing. Is he goes, first of all, in pursuit of wisdom. Knowledge. He's looking for wisdom. And that would be like philosophy, a worldview. He's going to try and put all the pieces together. So he did all these things, and he realized that he hits this ceiling and can't go any further. As if he's in this tunnel, and the more he studies, the more he realizes how hopeless we are, that we are going to be born, we're going to live without really understanding what's going on, and we're going to die. No matter what you accumulate in this tunnel, in this circle, in this created world, it's not going to last. It's all going to pass away. Your name is going to pass away. Your recognition is going to pass away. Your achievements, nothing you do, all your knowledge. If you did find any answers, how are you going to communicate it? And so he comes with the idea that wisdom is like a light, and this is all in the earliest chapters, that kind of shines a light in the tunnel that lets you realize really how hopeless you are. The more you know, the more you realize we really don't have any answers. Now we can expand. There's certain things God has given the man within this circle that he can use, explore, develop. But as far as certain questions, you're never going to find those answers. So then he turns to what he calls is foolishness. And again, when I explained this, that wasn't wickedness or sinfulness, but it was more of the carnal things. So in other words, since God has just given us what's inside this tunnel, let's see what we can do with it. Let's build buildings. Let's plant vineyards. Let's see if we can develop all these things that God has given to us. And at the end, in other words, just get yourself busy. That included pleasure. Wrap yourself up with what is in here. And that was like, in a sense, shutting the light off. You almost numbed yourself to the fact that you're in this tunnel, but as far as asking questions, you're just so busy building things, you don't realize you're in a tunnel trapped that you have no answers. And so he says, I explored wisdom and I explored foolishness. Wisdom was better because it was like light, but the light just gave you this very clear picture. We don't know the answer. So he says, what's best is for man, what is to just, instead of coming out here and trying to find what God has not permitted you to know. Job was in the same situation. God says, I'm not going to tell you these things. We don't even have the capacity to understand them. It's the in this circle is to find out what God has given you to do. And that is, one is to work, to find and enjoy the things God has provided for. There are things God has done, great things God has done. Enjoy them, experience them, work, and please God. Do good. He gives you a list of things. And one, that list included doing things that are good to others and what is available. So, in other words, with verse 22 of chapter 3, as we wrap this up, chapter 3, verse 22. So I saw that there's nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because that is his lot. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? So in other words, you are here today. You know that we understand God has revealed himself to us. It's not like we're not like you know, some false philosophy. We have the true philosophy. We have the philosophy of the Scriptures, the philosophy of Jesus Christ, if you would. There is a Creator, there is a Savior, and there is eternity. But now with that understanding, God has given us this time, this world, this life, to live in the creation, the reality He's given to us. So embrace it. This is where you're at. Don't try to recreate it. Don't try to deny it. Embrace what you have. So now we begin chapter 4. And as we look at chapter 4, if you look at your notes, first of all, I've got three pages there. I'm going to break it down into these areas. And obviously you can think about this yourself. And I think he's hitting different topics. And chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, the world is oppressive to everyone. In this world, he's going to say, it is oppressive. Now, understand, this world, this lines up with New Testament, and Old Testament, the whole concept. God created man, placed him in the garden with the intention of working. But man has fallen into sin, and so everything in this tunnel, in the created world, is under oppression. That agrees with Paul in Romans chapter 8, 9, 10, that he has subjected this world to frustration. And so that includes man and the way man interacts with each other. And so he talks there about oppression in verses 1 through 3. And it's a reality. You can't get away from it. Also, chapter 4, verse 4, the balance between striving in labor and satisfaction. You're going to have to work, but how much do you work? If you just sit on your hands and don't do anything, you're wasting your life. If you go out and make it all about how much you can accumulate, you've missed the point. So there's that balance. You can't just sit. You've got to work. But work itself, in a sense, has been perverted. Chapter 4, verse 7, there's a balance between achieving and enjoyment, kind of follows with what we just talked about. Then, beginning in chapter 4, verse 9, friendship and companionship are beneficial and necessary for success. One of the things he discovered is the necessity of having friends and other people. You can't live alone. And then the next point begins to talk about a kingship and deals with fads and the fickleness or popularity that comes and goes, which is very interesting for the season we're in right now. In fact, the book, of course, Ecclesiastes, there's something happening always in your life that's relevant. But the political season, you got political figures rising, and you got the crowd rising with them, but pretty soon there's a young upstart coming, and the crowd's going to move to someone else, and we're just like these cycles passing. And that's another thing that, as was mentioned earlier in the book that he described this, the word was door, D-O-R. It's translated generations. When it refers to people, it's generations of people just cycling through, cycle after cycle. But it also can refer to cycles, which refers to nature. And that can refer to seasons, the sun rising, the sun setting, the sun rising, the sun setting, the wind blowing from the north to the south and back again. And so there's just these cycles of going around and around. And when it's all said and done, when generation comes and goes, what happened? Nothing, because people are forgetting it as soon as it happens. And the sun rises and sets. What has happened? Well, it's starting to rise again. It's starting over again. And so it's these cycles of vanity. And so now we are in these cycles. Again, it's vanity when man tries to figure it out and find the answers. God has a purpose. We're not denying that God has a purpose, that God is working all things together for the good of those who love Him. But Solomon, or Koheleth, is discovering he doesn't know. He can't call the self-help seminar and explain the answers to life. And I threw that warning out earlier. If someone somewhere begins to give the impression they've got all the answers, that's a sure sign that there's probably something wrong. Because the Bible itself teaches you've been given a certain amount of information. Embrace that information, use that information, but understand you're going to hit a ceiling eventually, and you're not going to be able to answer everything in life. When people start talking about the mystery of this or the mystery of that, or I've discovered, it's like, whoa. Even Solomon tried to go there and says, I can't come back with anything reliable. Paul even went to heaven, went to the third heaven, apparently was in the presence of God himself, and came back and says, I saw things that I can't. I saw the answers, but I have no way of even understanding them, let alone communicating them. So there is always going to come that place for the human where they're going to run out of answers. And Job did, and he finally just got to say, I trust God, I know the Lord, and God has revealed himself. It's not blind faith, It's faith that you trust in what you know, but there's a place where you begin to live by faith, not by sight. Chapter 4, verse 1. I'm going to read down through the first three verses. Here we go. Again, I looked and saw the oppression that was taking place under the sun. And here it is. The topic right now is oppression. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressors, and they have no comforter. And I declared that the dead who have already died are happier than the living who are still alive, but better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. So to sum up those last two verses very quickly, he puts them in order, and I've got that list here on the notes there, kind of at the bottom of my discussion. Chapter 4, verse 3, the best choice is not to exist, not to be. Meaning, again, this sounds depressing, but it's Koheleth looking at what he can understand and saying this is, from his understanding, this is it. The world that you live in is oppressive. So it is best, if you are here, you're either oppressed or you're fighting to avoid being oppressed. But even if you aren't oppressed and you look around, there are people that are oppressed and you can't help them. There's a certain amount of how much you can help. We're limited. There's always, and again, we're going to read some verses here. There is this group of oppressed. And it is better for in this case right here, it is better to have lived and died. In other words, death in this case is better than life. You're living in this oppressed world. Look forward to the day of death because then this oppression is over. So death is better than being oppressed. Excuse me, did I write this wrong right here? So death, and the worst, is to be oppressed or alive. So the best case scenario is, number one, is not to even have existed, not even be born yet. Then you've never experienced this. The next best is to have lived and died. It's over. And the worst case scenario is to actually still be here going through this. And that's, again, Solomon's self-help seminar. Now, the problem with this book sometimes for our culture is this is not a real upbeat book. It is a very, I think, truthful book. It captures reality and put things in perspective. But it's not one of those books. We want a book about having your best life now. How can I avoid oppression? How can I get up and live on top and make the world fair for everybody? And this is saying that's impossible. You can't have your best life now. If you're having your best life now, somewhere along the line, you're oppressing someone to get to where we're crawling on each other. And so he's looking, and he's at the top of his game. This is a Solomon who's writing this. So he's at the top of his game. And he says in chapter 4, verse 1, I saw the tears of the oppressed. He looks out and he sees his kingdom. People are oppressed, and they have no comforter. Why? The power was on the side of the oppressors. So the person that is doing the oppressing, or the oppressor, is going to have the power. So whoever has the power is going to do the oppressing. It's just, there's a system. There are those who have the power and are oppressing others, and those who are under the oppression and they're trying to get out. So I wrote these things down. The literal translation, where it says right there, it says, on the side of their oppressors, there was power and there was no one to comfort them. The literal translation is, from the hand of their oppressors is power. In the hands of their oppressors is power. And so this concept is this. Whoever has the power is going to be oppressing the people, someone. And these people are now under the oppression of those. And the oppressor is going to maintain the power. They're always looking out for themselves because the way the system works. Remember, the system's been handed, even Paul says, I'll say it again, has been handed over to futility. We're not trying to teach the gospel here. We're not trying to explain, you know, the hope of eternal life or that there is a God and everybody be cheerful. We're trying to explain this tunnel that we're living in. And he's saying basically this concept. You are either the oppressor with the power crushing these people here. And if you are somehow going to get out of this, you're going to have to somehow gain the power. And an attempt, there's a struggle. There's a constant struggle. The second thing we see, point B. Koheleth recognizes the oppression of some people. Koheleth does not or cannot offer any advice or sympathy or solution. The thing about this that would drive Christians in the Western world crazy is Koheleth is not telling you the five-step program how you and your church can get together and solve this problem. He's saying, this is reality. If you are not oppressed, Someone is being oppressed, and you're part of the problem. Well, how can we resolve it? Well, if you sell all your possessions, you're going to find out if you don't take care of yourself, you're going to get oppressed. You've got to fight to stay alive. You've got to fight to stay on top. But in the process, someone's going to be oppressed. So he doesn't have an answer. In fact, he's going to end like always. This is vanity. This too is a cycle I can't break. Now, before you get all negative, say, well, we've got to be positive. Well, let me give you, we're going to have the Lord speak here in a minute, and you can see the verses. Point D, the very nature of reality is that the oppressor also has the power to maintain his position. And the oppressor is never, very rarely, unless there's some kind of a religious experience. And again, when I say religious experience, I don't mean Christian experience, where they're going to forfeit their power so that someone else can. Because once the people here gain the power, they're going to become the oppressor. There's never going to be this equal plane. It's just not built in the system. And I've said this for years, and you can judge me on this, and eventually I'm going to get in trouble from someone. But whenever there's a group of people that are oppressed and they want equal rights, we hear that all the time in our country, they according to this verse, this concept, they cannot mean equal rights. It is not in human nature. They want to have the power. And as soon as they have the power, what are they going to do according to Koheleth? They're going to become the oppressor and crush the other people. This struggle right here. Of course, with Christian values, you can achieve this. There's some kind of a balance. But you're in this world. Well, look right here. Notice point F before we get too far with this. This will not change. Jesus affirmed this. And before we read Jesus' words in Matthew, Mark, and John, read Deuteronomy, because this is where Jesus gets it from. Deuteronomy 15:11. For there will never cease to be poor in the land. There will never cease to be the oppressed in the land. Therefore I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy, and to the poor in your land. There is the Christian principle. There is the Mosaic law. You will always have the oppressed. You cannot erase the oppressed. They're always going to be there. Those of you who are, in a sense, with the power, with the money, or in the position of the oppressor, is not to crush them, but to help hand it out. Give it to them and assist them in their oppression. But you're never going to form this equilateral, perfect culture where everybody's balanced. It is, in reality, it is impossible. According to the law of Moses and Deuteronomy, Jesus says this in Matthew 26, "For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me." Now, we're going to come back to that, not always have me, in just a moment. Mark 14, "For you always have the poor with you, and whatever you want, you can do good for them, but you will not always have me." So again, he's talking about doing good for the poor. You're not going to get rid of the oppressed, but you can help the oppressed from your position of power. And that's the Christian principle, not to keep grinding people, but to assist them. But you're not going to be able to just somehow magically break reality and bring everybody up on an equal plane. That's not possible. It's not my opinion. It's the way Koheleth discovers it here in Ecclesiastes. It's the way Deuteronomy, Moses' day, explained it. And Jesus confirmed it. You will always have it. The problem's going to be, and I think this is where the problem comes for us as Christians, is this. When Jesus says, "You will not always have me." Now, he's talking about the fact that he needs them at that time, instead of Judas, days before Jesus' execution, Judas faking like he cares about the poor. Jesus says, no. He says, this is about me. You're always going to have the poor with you. Judas, don't make this about changing reality. Deuteronomy explains it. Koheleth in the book of Ecclesiastes has explained it. And now you're trying to make my death and resurrection, my coming as Savior, something about the poor. You're always going to have the poor to deal with. He says, this is about me. And so one of the problems that we've got is when we take our eyes off of Jesus, and people will use the name of Jesus in a wrong way, and we drop down here and make the gospel about the poor people. The gospel is not about the poor making everybody equal. The gospel is not a social movement to make everybody equal, everybody same pay, everybody on the same health care program. The gospel is about who? Jesus Christ coming to save the world. And our nature being changed into His image. And now that we're changed into His image, now we can be, like Moses says, be open-handed towards the poor. We can do what we can to help the poor. There's a day, Jesus was telling Judas, there's a day coming for you to take the nature that you're going to be given as far as being born again in the image of Jesus Christ and begin to help the poor. But right now, this is about Jesus. Again, the point here is Koheleth is telling you something crucial. Chapter 4, verse 1. Again, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and there was no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressors, and they have no comforter. In other words, Solomon was the wealthy. Solomon was the one paying the workers. Solomon was the one with the slaves. And he says, there's no way to solve this. This is the cycle. And I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living, who are still alive, but better than both, the living and the dead, is he who has not been, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. And once again, the evil that is under the sun is the futility that creation was subjected to by the Lord himself that Paul refers to in Romans chapter 8 and 9. So there's that talk about the oppression. Again, it's not a happy message. I mean, there's no candidate going to stand up and make this presentation that life sucks. This is the way it's going to be. There's going to be the rich. There's going to be the poor. There's going to be the oppressor. There's going to be the oppressed. The best thing we can offer you is that the oppressor, when he's got the power, that he's open-handed to those who are oppressed and is gracious and kind and helps them out. But there's no way you're going to change the reality. You're not going to be able to create a false philosophy that everybody is equal. It's not in Deuteronomy. It's not in Ecclesiastes. It's not in the Gospels. It's not in the New Testament. It's nowhere in Christian philosophy that you can make everybody equal. You can, though, become saved and be formed in the image of Jesus Christ and be open-handed and assist the poor, but you're not going to eradicate it. And that is kind of an interesting topic, and I'm done with that. So now we go on to chapter 4, verse 4. Now he goes on to these next verses, chapter 4, verse 4, down to verse 6. So let me read these. Verse 4. And I saw that all the labor and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbor. So now we're going to talk about labor or work. And I want to point out as we begin to look at this, that man was created in the Garden of Eden to work the garden. So I've got this written down there on point A under point chapter 4, verse 4. Again, it's a very crude illustration, if you would. A bird was made to fly, and we've talked about before. Going back to chapter 3, verse 20, chapter 3, verse 9, if you don't mind, please. What does the worker gain from his toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on men. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Now, this is going back to a couple weeks ago. Everything is beautiful in its time. And this is, again, Paul says this, all things work together for the good of those who love the Lord. Similar idea. God has made everything beautiful in its time. So everything and time. The problem that we have is we do not know how that all works together. We don't know how everything works, and we don't know the right time sometimes. Sometimes it's time to go to war. Sometimes it's time for peace. How do you know you made the right decision? Sometimes it's time to look for a lost item. Sometimes it's time to stop looking for it. How do you know you made the right decision? This is the problem. We don't know how everything works, nor do we know the exact time. But God has made everything beautiful in its time. So you're living in a beautiful life. You just don't understand how beautiful it is or if you've made the right decision. And the difference between us and an animal, this is from a few weeks ago, an animal is designed, like a bird is designed, just make it simple, designed to fly. So the bird flies, looks for food, pecks at food, and lives. The bird never starts just floating up higher in the air just saying, I don't know, I just don't understand life. The bird doesn't ask that question. The bird just flies, finds food, eats, flies, goes to sleep, gets up. The squirrel, like I got written down here, the bird was made to fly. The fish was made to swim. The squirrel was made to gather nuts or whatever. You can get more scientific if you want to. But you don't see squirrels having a little console on my deck saying, I don't know. I've called you guys all together because there's some things I've been thinking about. I don't know. Isn't there more to life than gathering nuts? It's like, they don't have the ability. And that comes in this very next word, next verse, verse 11 of chapter 3. He has made everything beautiful in his time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. In other words, everything is perfect. Your problem is you're not a bird. You're not a squirrel. You've got something in your heart that can actually come to a Bible study, sit in a circle and say, you know, I thought there was more to this than just gathering nuts. Or there's something more to just driving around in our car. There's something bigger going on outside the circle. And the problem Solomon is finding with man is you're not just an animal. Is he's got to set something in your heart's eternity, yet you cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. So it sounds like a positive. God has set eternity in your hearts, but yet you don't understand it. You've got a hunger. You've got a desire. You're raising your hands. You're asking questions. You're seeking God. Why is this happening? Why do I get up every day, just go to the same job day after day after day? It's like, what is the meaning to life? Ah, I'm glad you're asking. That means you're not a squirrel. Yes, but I want to know. Ah, you'll never know. It's like, ah. And so if you read this again, he has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. In other words, sometimes you just want to cry out, take this humanity from me and just let me be a man who's happy to go to work. I'm a squirrel. I gather nuts. I'm a bird. I fly. I'm a man. I go to work, come back home, eat supper, go to sleep, get back up, and go to work. It's like, and I never ask any questions. But the problem is God has made you bigger and you're trapped in this circle. So with that being said, we go back to chapter 4, verse 4. And I saw that all labor and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Just like a squirrel was made to gather nuts, a bird was made to fly, man in the Garden of Eden was made to work. He was made to labor. It was not a negative thing, any more than it's negative for a bird to fly. Man was created to work. The problem comes, we've fallen into that created sin world, the world of sin, the cosmos. And now, with this desire to be a man, to work, to be productive, we're also, right after the verse about being oppressed, we're now into this system where we're working not just because we're men, not just because it's productive, it's what we're made for. We've got this thing, money, or power, or product, or avoidance of being oppressed, something that we're working for. The Bible here calls it, right here, envy. I'll read it again. This is Solomon or Koheleth speaking. And I saw that all labor and all activity spring from man's evil of his neighbor. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. In other words, God made man to work, to be productive, and there should be this element of satisfaction, of I went to work today, I built this. Almost that art, I don't want to stretch this too far, but it's almost the, and I've experienced, and you've all experienced at some level, I think, maybe. It's that satisfaction, almost like art. It's like, I made this. Why? Because I was productive, I was busy, it's useful, it's artistic, I think it looks good. Well, how much is it worth? I didn't even think about that. I was just being a squirrel, gathering nuts. I was just a bird flying, looking for grain. I was just a man. I was just making something. I was producing something. And all of a sudden, we get in this cycle of where oppression is, in this cave of the fallen world, handed over to futility. It's like, now, if you make 500 of those, you can make more money and won't be oppressed. In other words, he says, all that man does, Solomon says, I saw all the labor and all the achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbor, not from the original purpose of being a man who's working in the garden, being productive, but trying to get ahead. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. And when he says meaningless, that's that word havel, which means a vapor. It's passing away. It's temporary. This is not the truth. When it says this too is meaningless, it means all your labor is to achieve and be envious of your neighbor. That motivation is passing away. That's not the original purpose. And also a chasing after the wind, it's a cycle. It's a cycle that's going nowhere. Once you achieve this, realize you're not going to get, you're going to just have to do it again. In other words, it's never fulfilling, and it's passing away. But yet he doesn't say, if that's the case, then I'm going to be a good Christian, and I'm not going to strive, and I'm not going to work. I'm just going to pray, fast, seek God. It's like, no, you are a man. A squirrel was made to gather nuts, a bird was made to fly, a fish was made to swim in the water, and a man was made to work. So, sorry, but you've got to work. Now, this ties right into the epistles. Same thing Jesus talked about it. It goes throughout the whole Bible. You have to work. But it's vanity. I'm just doing it to get money, to get ahead. Right. We are living in a fallen world. It's a futile world. If what's your alternative? Well, here's your alternatives. So he gives you basically three alternatives here. Verse 5. The fool. So now, if you don't want to accept this philosophy. Now, again, we're not saying I understand everything. I'm just saying man was designed to work. And now man is in a fallen system that if you don't work and compete, you're going to get rolled over by somebody. Well, that's stupid. That's vanity. That's just exactly because I want to live for God. I want to live for eternity. Well, you can't right now. You've got to live for Monday morning. You've got to live for the paycheck. You are in this cycle that Solomon's been talking about. You can't escape this. And so if you want to be a fool, say, well, I don't agree with that. I'm going to create my own alternate reality. I'm going to live in a world of socialism where they're just going to give us stuff. Okay, well, now you are the fool. It's like you're not. I'm not saying this is a great system. In fact, God says it's cursed. Paul says it's been handed over to futility by the Lord himself. Man fell. Man brought this creation into a disaster. It's going to pass away. And it's frustrating for man because he's got eternity stamped on his heart and he's in this a cycle of vanity. So the fool folds his hands and ruins himself. Or if you read right there, I think I've got a... on page 2 now, I believe, right there. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. That's another translates the English Standard Version. In other words, the fool will end up, it translates, the NIV tries to translate so it makes sense, he destroys himself. Or in other words, if you don't work, if you don't embrace this vicious cycle we're in, you're going to end up eating yourself. You're going to end up destroying yourself and you have nothing. So the fool is the one who says, I'm going to create my own world, my own universe. Okay, well, that's not going to work. You're going to consume yourself. Now, again, I could get political very fast right there, but basically that's where much of our nation is at right there, and we are now consuming ourselves, and we're about out. We're about ready to just, well, again, figure that out yourself. Okay, so the fool folds his hand, creates his own alternate reality that's not true, and ruins himself. You have to work. You're a man. You can't create your own universe. Verse 6. But better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and the chasing after the wind. So you've got the fool who doesn't want to work, and this is emphasized throughout the scriptures, and now you're going to have, we're just right down here, the two-handed man and the one-handed. The one-handed man is really what Solomon's talking about. It's very simple. He's talking about balance. You've got to embrace work. You've got to be productive. You've got to be competitive. Sometimes even in school, they want to get rid of competition. It's like that's teaching this right. There's no competition. We're all the same. It's like, no, I'm sorry. I am sorry that we live in my Creator's universe. We live in my Creator's universe where there's winners and there's losers. There's sleepers and there's those who are awake. Those who are the winners need to reach out and help those who haven't figured it out yet. But we all can't just stand around and pretend we're living in the Garden of Eden. That day came and left. So it's like, well, that's a bad philosophy. Well, I'm sorry, that's my philosophy. That's what the Bible teaches. See, it's not just about saying, well, I believe in, for me. You don't have to agree with me on this. It's not just about saying, I believe in Jesus. I mean, how many people believe in Jesus? Muslims believe in Jesus. It's about believing in Jesus Christ as Creator, Savior, and soon coming King, and believing in His Word, which means His revelation. Well, yeah, the Gospel teaches Jesus died on the cross for our sins. Yeah, that's like in like four books and about two pages of those four books. We're talking about an entire philosophy here, and part of that philosophy is God created a world that man brought into sin that is now living in futility, that is vanity, and you've got to work to survive. And if you don't work to survive, someone with a sin nature is going to rise up and oppress you, and now you are the oppressed, and you're in a false philosophy. I wish that wasn't true. Well, I wish it wasn't true either. But we're living between the fall of man and the return of Jesus Christ, and that's the frustration of the book of Ecclesiastes. We're in this tunnel, and the more you know, the more wisdom you gain, you realize the light comes on, you realize how hopeless it is. Let's just shut the light off and start building buildings and getting busy with the things in the world so we don't realize how hopeless it is. Yes, sir. See, and people, see, now watch this. The fool will say, well, let's all just get along. Now, coming down here, you got the one-hand and two-hand guy that we got that in verse 6. Better one handful with tranquility. In other words, you got one hand full. You've worked your day. You've worked your fields. You've done what you need to do. You've got what you need. And that you still have one hand free. And that one hand is free for relationships. It's free for family. It's free for enjoying the things. God created the world. Paul teaches us to enjoy the world. That's part of Solomon's explanation here. The best God can give you, enjoy your work and enjoy your life and enjoy your wife. And life is good, but you got to go to work. So one hand is full, and that means one hand is free. But notice right here, better one hand with tranquility, that's this middle one, than this one, two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. In other words, you're trying to get some in this hand, and in this hand, you're shutting off the enjoyment. You're shutting off, I just want more stuff, and I'm going to work extra hour and get more stuff, and now you got two hands full, and now what are you doing? You're chasing after the wind. You're right back into that field. You're in a cycle. You're like the sun going up and down. Don't you realize the sun is just, we're in this cycle. It's just repeating itself. Just get one handful and enjoy life. No, I'm going to get two handfuls. It's like in the process of getting two handfuls, you're going to be filled with toil, and you're going to get into a cycle that you're just like the sun. You get up, go to work, come back, get back up, and just over and over, like the north or the wind blowing from the north to the south. You're wrong. You're a fool for being up here and just sitting, devouring yourself, and you're a fool for working endlessly, trying to get more and more of this world that's passing away. The best, and this is Solomon's advice, is you've got to work, but one handful's enough. No balance. And so again, that's interesting information right there, especially after coming after the oppressed. I would say as a Christian, this one handful is your work, whatever you need to take care of yourself, your family. Paul worked. And again, the other hand would be the relationships, the family, or if we go back to verses 1 through 4, it's the open-handed towards those who are less fortunate. And that wouldn't be necessarily just giving money to the fool, but it'd be helping those who are less fortunate. I would say this fool right here needs to come to Bible class. And I can help you, not by giving you money, but giving you this basic reality check right here. This is the way the world works. You know, it's not even mine. I mean, I'm reading the text. You understand this text is going to get us in trouble more ways than one eventually. It's not just the verses about homosexuality. It's going to be verses like this. And when you begin to understand who Jesus really is, not only at the end does he judge and make war, Jesus is telling you, suck it up. This is reality. This is the way the world is. It's like, well, that's not very loving. It's like, it's as loving as you can get of teaching and instructing the truth. This is where you live. You don't live on planet Pluto. You live on planet Earth. Okay. Chapter 4, verse 7. Again, here's the third topic. Again, I saw something meaningless under the sun. Again, there's your word vanity, habel, which means vapor passing away, temporary. He says, there was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with wealth. We may be potentially describing this person, this two-handed man. It appears right here, he's all alone, and that may be by choice, potentially, or it may be because of just the situation he's in. Maybe he's on a deserted island. But as you read through this, there was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. Now, you can't really help not having a brother. You can help having a son, possibly, or at least offspring, you get a wife. But it appears right here, there was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. Instead of being about relationships, a son and a brother, and living up here with this one hand full, the one hand open, he's got two hands full. He doesn't have time for people. Yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. And then he asked, for whom am I toiling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. In other words, he finds himself with all of this stuff, but in the process of getting all of this stuff, he's cut out certain things in his life as simple as, not necessarily, you know, the cruise, you know, the Mediterranean cruise or whatever, you know, the huge house. He's deprived himself of relationships. He's deprived himself of people. He's been so busy using people to get his hands full that he's deprived himself of these basic enjoyments. And he says right here, this too is meaningless, vanity, emptiness, a miserable business. This is a miserable life. So that kind of explains some of those. And that is right in the middle of page 2, the balance between achieving and enjoyment. There's no... this is interesting, I think. Because Christianity can go, like any religion, in the ditch on one side or the other. They can go the way of We're all just going to make everybody equal, put all of our money together and become this socialistic community and everyone deserves the same thing. That's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches there's going to be winners and losers. There's going to be those who have and those who do not have. Those who have need to become Christ-like and continue to win and assist those who are falling behind. That's the way the world works. Or one of them is it's wrong to enjoy the earth. Paul talked about enjoyment. Jesus was about enjoying the things of the earth. Right here, he says, for whom am I toiling, he asked, and why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless, a miserable business. One of the gifts that Solomon mentions here in Ecclesiastes is one of the gifts. When you find yourself with the ability to enjoy life, Solomon had said earlier already, that is a gift from God. If you can get into a position where you say, I'm actually enjoying this. I'm enjoying this moment. Solomon says, that's a gift from God. Because not everybody has the ability to do that. Some people are fools and they never work for anything, and so they destroy themselves. Others get so wrapped up in the created things, they get more and more stuff, they never relax and enjoy it. They just get, and they're in a meaningless cycle. If you find yourself in that balance of being able to work and follow God's plan for work and being able to recognize when you have enough, Paul said that, we'll be content if we have food and clothing. He was talking about his apostolic ministry. If we have food and clothing, we'll be content with that. And then we're done. Then we're done. We're going to go and do something else. In his case, he was an apostle. He gave his life to a ministry, but you can enjoy life. So again, there's that balance. There's nothing wrong with working and nothing wrong with enjoying life. In fact, those are the commands. If you don't find yourself ever enjoying life, there's a problem. If you don't find yourself ever working, there's a problem. And some people would call that Christianity. It's like, well, I never enjoy anything. I'm always committed to the Lord. I'm always sad. I'm always oppressed. Well, that's not God. Or I don't work, I just trust God. Well, that's not God. Reality is working and enjoying life. That is called the gift from God. And again, this is Old Testament, but it's more about the philosophy, the way the universe is set up in this fallen state. But it is all, I think, confirmed in the Gospels and in the New Testament, in the epistles. Okay, that's chapter 4, verse 8. Now we go to chapter 4, verse 9. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they'll keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. And now we're into this. We're talking now about relationships. I'll write the word relationships. And that can include friends, it can include family, and here's some examples of that right here. And this is a man, basically here, a man is not designed to be alone. Even that comes out of Genesis 2. It is not good for a man to be alone. So here we have right here, I got bottom of page 2, it says, friendship and companionship are beneficial and necessary for success. Point A, relationships and friendships are a necessary part of life. Point B, below is a list of coalesced discoveries for the need of other people in your life. And there are basically four things he's going to mention. One, two, see if I can keep up with this and do this in some kind of orderly fashion. The first one, two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. So if you can work alone, that's good. I work alone a lot. And there's part about being an individual. Adam worked alone in the garden for a long time, apparently, or some, at least a period of time. But the idea is there is working. If you can have two working together, you're going to have a good return for your work. In other words, if you can invest two people in a project, it's a biblical principle again. You're going to multiply your efforts if you have two working together. You're going to be able to feed off of each other's ideas. You're going to be able to feed off of each other's work. You're going to be able to help lift things, support things that you couldn't do by yourself. So in other words, you're going to be able to get more done with two people than with one people in certain situations. And he's saying right here, two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. So the first point there on 4:9, I write down, first, work is more productive. So work, two working is more productive. So productivity, when you got two people working together. That's the first point that he says because he's been talking about working. Work is designed to be done by people working together. Again, a great illustration is ants working together and all that they can get done. Verse 10, if one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. The second point is that this world is danger. This world we've already discussed. I mean, we can call it a happy world and colorful world and all the beautiful things in the world. But we began this chapter talking about how oppressive this world was. Solomon talked about this world being a vanity, all the evil that's in the world. And so this is, in a sense, a dangerous world. And at some point in your life, every man is going to fall down in some way. They're going to get to a place where they need someone to help them up. If it's jumping your car battery in the parking lot at the mall, if it's something, you're going to need some help. And Solomon's just pointing this out. I write this, point A. Second, in this world of danger, oppression, every man is too weak to make it without someone to assist him in times of need. So this right here, danger, two or better in times of need, you're going to need someone. Again, this doesn't mean everybody in the world has to be your friend, but you're going to have some people. This is about relationships. And you're going to have to be that person for some other people. You're going to have to be the guy getting your car jumped sometimes. Sometimes you're going to be the guy with the jumper cables. And then that next point on top of page 3. In other words, investing in friendships and relationships will have a great benefit. You can't just roll past people, use people. At some point, you've got to start investing in not just your retirement, investing in your business. You've got to start investing in people for you to be successful. Not because you're using people, but eventually you're going to fall down and you're going to need help. So this Solomon's talking about relationships. One, you need other people because you're going to be more productive. Two, you're going to need people because you're going to come to a time of need where you need help up. Number 11, chapter 4, verse 11. An interesting verse. I'll read it in my NIV. It says, also, here's the third point, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? In other words, the basic concept here is, and again, I write here on the notes, point B, and we'll read point B first. This is not necessarily referring to a married couple or sexual relations, but of course it does not exclude these either. But is instead using the physical exchange of natural body heat to serve as an example of the exchange of natural soulish heat. I made that phrase up myself. Soulish heat of encouragement and admiration. In other words, you've got, I'm going to write the word emotion. And this would involve someone admiring you, someone encouraging you. We all have, it's just like two people, they lay down, I've got body heat. Another person, say my wife, for make it easy, she's got body heat, and it happens many times, and same, I'm sure, with other people. You wait in the middle of the night, you wake up, you're cold, you snuggle up together, your body heat heats each other up. That's a typical example. That's what he's referring to here. Talk about two people. It doesn't have to be husband and wife in this case. There's no sexual content explicit in this verse. But it's talking here about body heat warming up another body. But the same thing can be true between a person to another person. A person's soul can transfer heat, energy, emotion, encouragement, admiration to help fire up somebody else. And that's right here. It says, also, if two lie down together, they'll keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? How can one person keep encouraging themselves day after day? Sometimes they can. They look at what they got done. Sometimes they can. They look at their goals. They look at their productivity. But eventually it's going to come a time where you emotionally or somehow you need another person to, if it's just physically, warm you up. And this is, I think, talking here. I write this down. Point A at the top of page 3 under chapter 4, verse 11. This could refer to emotional support. Every traveler in this world needs support, encouragement, and admiration from someone else. Now, that traveler in this world means everyone passing through this dark, dark tunnel. You need someone at some time to encourage you. I'll just write encourage right here as if somebody can actually read it. Encourage. And now the fourth one. For chapter 4, verse 12. Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. And now this is talking about in some kind of a struggle. In military, I write these things down and kind of follow that. Is in military, if you're fighting and you just look at the way your body's designed, your body's designed to receive help from another person. Because my eyes are facing this way, my hands are this way, I naturally walk this direction. Everything is here. This is where I play defense, or this is where I shoot. I play offense from this side. But you can't play with your back. In a basketball game, in a military battle, I'm weak. On my backside, I have no sight. My hands are awkward. I can't move backwards as well as I can move forward. You're weak on the backside. Basically, everybody needs someone covering their backside. And this is an illustration I've got it written down in reference. 1 Samuel 14 of when Jonathan and David climbed up this cliff and attacked the Philistines. It says they fought how? Back to back. And this is exactly what this is referring to. Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. If I'm fighting on this side, this is my offensive side. I've got my hands, I've got all my senses are focused right here. I've got this side covered. But on my backside, I'm weak. Well, if I've got someone fighting for themselves with their back to my back, they're fighting for themselves, but they're protecting my back. I'm fighting for myself here, but I'm protecting their back. And so two right here, though one may be overpowered, like if David had climbed that ledge by himself and attacked the Philistines, there's examples in the book of Judges of men fighting by themselves and doing great exploits. The concept there would be that David had climbed up there, fought by himself, he would have been overpowered from the backside. But with Jonathan fighting back to back to him, they overcame the Philistines. Now that's back to back. The simple point is here, is you've got back to back, how about, and you're in a 180 position, a 180 against 180, you know, one side against one side. What would happen if you'd go into triangular formation and you'd have three people back to back and you've got three sides fighting? Now that's what he says right here. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. If you go from just back to back to a triangular position of three in some kind of a conflict, and that fourth point there is simply in a matter of defense or assistance, of defending each other, you're going to be in a better position. He's simply saying right there, you're going to need people to be productive. With people, you'll be more productive. You're going to be in some kind of danger in this world. You're going to have someone help you up. You're going to have someone to heat you up sometimes, emotionally. You're going to have encouragement. You can't do this alone. Every traveler needs to be warmed up somewhere. And defending yourself, you can defend yourself, but you're always going to have a weak spot. If you have some relationships with people, someone can have your back. But likewise, you can read this the other way around. You're going to be serving other people in that capacity at some level. Not only are you receiving that, you can be providing that for somebody else. I like to think of my wife and I as doing this, and you guys in the same situation. My wife, I'm the second part of her. Her life is better most of the time because I'm there. If she falls down, she's going to have some little surgery this week. Well, I can take off work and I can take her to the doctor, and I'm there to help her. Otherwise, she'd have to find somebody, but I'm the one that's there. To lie down, we can encourage each other. Many times we encourage each other. We're each other's friends forever, you know, best friends forever, and we can defend each other. And as I try to help myself, I've got her back. As she's trying to help herself, she's got my back. And again, that's, again, a great marriage verse there, but it's more than a marriage verse. They can be applied to friendship, that can be applied to business, that can be applied to warfare, that can be applied to just basic friendship, just basic life. And again, especially that can be exploited in a church in a positive way of the body of Christ coming together and applying that. Anyway, that's what those verses are talking about. A basic thing in this reality, in this tunnel that we live in, although it's dark, we're trapped in this, we don't understand certain things, those are 1, 2, 3, 4 points he can tell you. These are four things I discovered that you're going to need in this dark tunnel. You're going to need some people. And you're going to be somebody's person. Chapter 4, verse 13. Now we wrap this up. And this is really kind of an interesting topic right now. Because it's basically talking about cycles. We get wrapped up in... here he's going to be talking about a king. And he's going to be talking about a youth. And then he's going to be talking about a youth in prison. Or someone that's in prison. Is going to be talking about a king. This king right here in our illustration here that Koheleth is giving us, this king is old, he's got great experience, but he's kind of got set in his ways and he's unresponsive, he's unaware of his environment. He's not attentive. He was popular, he got the position. He's settled. I'll write the word settled. He's content. He's not interested in changing. He's oblivious to certain things going on in his kingdom because they don't matter to him. He's settled. He's content. Now, this youth is coming out of the kingdom. This youth right here in the next illustration, if they're the same, some would say they're the same, some say they're different, but he's coming out of prison. And he's not content. We'll say he's hungry. He's hungry for change. He sees the things that need to be changed. He's attuned to what the people need and what's going on. We could call this fads. You can see this. You can see this in music. You can see this in movie stars. You can see this in businesses. Businesses reach that top of the curve and they start to fade away. Sadly to say, the way modern churches are built in the Western world, churches are the same thing. If you don't agree with me, just look at the churches in town. There's the bubble. There's the curve. There's the bubble. They rise, they reach their peak. They're the glory days of the 70s. And then they taper off and they're done because they're set up like a business. They fade, their fade's coming. And then there's a new guy in town, and he reaches his peak, and he builds the mega church, and he's going to fade. That's the way businesses go. That's the way politics go. That's the way the world goes. It goes in cycles. So don't be impressed. So here we go. Chapter 4, verse 13. Better a poor. All right, this changes from poor, from youth to poor. Better a poor, but wise youth, than an old but foolish king. He's poor, but he's wise. He's poor, but he's hungry. He's poor, but he's on the rise. It's better to be on this side of the curve than over here. It's better to be on this side, down here, fighting your way up, hungry, in need, in tune with the needs of the people, aware of what's going on, than to be right up here, the king, over here. Because now he's old and foolish. He's settled. He's built, he's now an institution. His name's recorded in history. Now, we're going to come back to that in just a moment to remember the ideal of history in this concept. Better a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. The youth may have come from prison to the kingship. You want to write the book on how, you know, the positive self-help book right now, have your best life now. This is where you do it right now. The youth, in this system, in the tunnel that we live in the world that's been handed over to futility, in this system, it is possible to be the poor youth in prison in the king's kingdom because you're attentive, because you're hungry, because you're alert, you're resourceful. You can rise out of that prison. You can rise to the kingship. And we're not talking about America or the American dream. We're talking about Israel in a world at this time where there was kings and monarchies. He says right here, the youth may, I mean, Solomon found this out. Koheleth is saying, in this system, it may be oppressive, it may be ununderstandable, we may not say it's vanity, but in this system, you can rise from prison to the kingship if you're attentive. The youth may have come from prison to the kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom, the king's, the old king's kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun follow the youth, the king's successor. So in other words, he's saying, this guy can, you know, if you're here, you can rise up, but you better be careful, because if you're not paying attention, you're going to go through the cycle and you're going to be down here on the downside. He says, and now he's going to talk about history. If you don't mind, I'm going to try to make this connection right here. Here's, now we're looking at history as far as a timeline. Actually, Solomon always sees it as a cycle. But you're going to have this first king, we'll just say the old king. Then we're going to say the youth. And as he reads this, watch this. He says, the youth may have come from prison, verse 14, to the kingship, or he may have been born in poverty within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. That as this king here, as he faded away, there was this movement, this cycle of people, the generations of people coming. They began to follow this youth. On his rise, they began to follow him. They're all coming. But the problem is, this youth is going to do this right here. He's going to fade. If nothing more, he's going to get old and die. But these cycles are going to continue. There's always going to be this wave of people. So now we're talking now about cycles of people, or the people that are pushing the fad, or pushing the popularity, or pushing the politics. Why is the king at the top? Because he's got the people behind him. But these people are, they're going to just keep right on coming. But eventually, this king right here, who was on the top of his game, is going to be forgotten in history. This youth, who was the youth that came out of prison, he had the momentum, he was the celebrity, he's going to rise, the people are going to push him to the top, but he's going to run his cycle, and he's going to disappear, and the people are just going to keep right on going. In other words, down here on this side, they don't even remember these two kings. This guy was a hero, came out of prison. He's come and gone. We hope we made a movie about him, because otherwise we'll forget him. Verse 16, there was no end to all the people who were before them, but those who came later were not pleased with the successor. This too is meaningless. In other words, all the people, there's no number here. They came and they went, and now over here, it just keeps on going. And no one remembers these two people that struggled for political power. They struggled for popularity. They rode the wave of popularity. They built the big business. They built the big ministry. They built the big whatever. They came, they left, and people just kept right on going and forgot about them. The point is, this too is meaningless, but it is a point of time. Be careful. This is the way it works. The old king is going to fade. The young king is going to come up. If he's hungry, he's going to rise, but he's got to realize he's going to fade away, and history is just going to keep right on moving, and he's going to be left in the dust. So he says this too is meaningless. In other words, political popularity or the rise of politics is too, this too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. So again, we talked about several subjects there this evening. Chapter 5 will begin next week. This begins to deal with religion. We begin to talk about stand in awe. My NIV says stand in awe of God. And the warning begins, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. This is some advice. Basically, I'll say this about the beginning there, is this. You need to take God serious because God is taking you serious. When you go to the house of God, it's God is watching. And you're going to make some kind of vow. You're going to go through some kind of ritual. God's taking it serious. And you're just in there flippantly going through motions and going through rituals. But God is paying attention. And he's taking your vows, he's taking your words, he's taking your commitment, he's taking your actions serious, and he's expecting it to come out on the other side of life somewhere where you're going to follow through. So be careful. It's better for you not to go than to go and be flippant about your religious experience before God, because he's taking you serious, you should take him serious. And that's kind of what he's going to be saying next, is religion can become a very dangerous thing if you don't take it serious. I'll pray and you're dismissed. I appreciate you coming. Father, we thank you for your truth. We thank you for your word. We ask again that we may hear it, that we may apply it. And I ask that the things I shared would bring insight, but also, Father, that there'd be room for people to make corrections and make correct application for their own lives. Father, we do thank you again for your truth. And I ask that we may continue to uncover the wisdom and the revelation you presented to us in the Scriptures, and that we may use it in a rightful way in our own lives. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.